Hello and welcome to the Sunday Salon, the podcast that celebrates brilliant books and the women who write them. My guest today, Atega Uwagba, is an inspiration. Age 25, fed up with her job in advertising, she quit and decided to establish herself as a freelance journalist, setting up the networking platform Women Who and self-publishing Little Black Book, a toolkit for working women. After a sellout print run, it was snapped up by a publisher and became a Sunday Times bestseller. Now, Atega's working on another book, We Need to Talk About Money, due out next year. But the aftermath of George Floyd's death and the global outpouring of anguish prompted her to set aside the latter and write Whites on Race and Other Falsehoods, an absolutely brilliant analytical essay which dissects uncomfortable truths about racism and white complicity and points out some of the problems with the reaction to the Black Lives Matter movement from otherwise well-meaning white people. I found both the book and our conversation absolutely riveting and enlightening, and I hope you do too. Atega, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on the Sunday Salon.
Thank you for having me, Alice.
I'm so excited to talk to you, as you know, and I thought the book was absolutely brilliant, and there's so much that I want to talk to you about, and there were so many just really nuanced original points so elegantly expressed. You write about how you put the book together over the summer when it sort of felt like, you know, the world was coming to an end, but it drew on notes you'd been taking for the previous 5 years. Can you just tell me a little bit about that, how it kind of went from you taking notes, why you were taking those notes in the first place and how that started, and then the sort of solidification of that into, you know what, I'm going to put this into an essay and I'm going to aim to have that published?
Sure. So I first started making notes on things that have, you know, now cropped up in the essay, as you said, about 5 years ago. So at the time, I was still working in advertising, which is what I used to do before writing. And I was working in an environment that, if I'm honest, just felt quite hostile and was kind of full of all sorts of microaggressions on a kind of daily basis. And I think at that point I was also thinking about the fact that I wanted to get into journalism or writing, and I felt like writing about race or racism, at the time I thought that that would kind of be my entry into that world. It ended up not being, which was, you know, quite a conscious choice, but I just started writing these things down. Like, I've always been a writer, and so it was quite natural to me. I literally had a Google Doc and would sometimes just write paragraphs or anecdotes, because I didn't want to forget stuff. I find that when you don't kind of write down these things in the moment, and especially how you're feeling about them and the details, often it can just kind of merge into like a big blur. So I started making these notes, and then maybe about a year and a half ago, it occurred to me that I wanted to write an essay. Well, I wanted to pitch an article actually to like an online publication about racism and identity and whiteness, and that would probably have been just quite a short, you know, online essay. But I also felt, I just kind of realized, I felt like I might not be allowed to write it on my own terms. And I mean, not that this essay wasn't edited, obviously it was edited by my editor at my publisher, but I think there are certain imperatives that come with writing like a sort of 1500 or 2000 word essay for a digital media platform that I just felt like would slightly strangle what I wanted to say. So I decided to just kind of keep it for myself. And I thought at some point I would write a sort of a published essay, like, you know, a physical essay. And so I'd kind of just making these notes, but as you know, I have another book coming out next year, next May, so that was my main focus. So I'd always imagined that I would publish this essay on race after that, but then George Floyd was killed back in May and the world exploded, and, you know, white people responded in all these surprising and also, you know, sometimes very unsurprising ways. And I just suddenly felt like the things that I'd wanted to say for a really long time really, really ought to be said right now. And that if I wanted the essay to be widely read, now would be the time to publish it whilst people were kind of still having these conversations. And it just essentially this past summer gave it all a renewed sense of urgency. And there was so much overlap between what I'd been making notes on and the sort of conversations that happened post George Floyd, that it just really felt like the right moment, and I felt like I kind of owed it to myself. So I put the book I was working on to one side and just kind of sort of knuckled down on this essay for a little while.
You describe the sort of overarching theme of your notes and subsequently the essay as sort of
white people and what is required to coexist with them if you yourself are not white. And you kind of then take issue with that yourself, because you didn't really want to write an essay about being black that placed white people at its centre. Can you tell me about that kind of, I suppose, internal struggle and how you resolved it and kind of realised you had to go ahead anyway?
Yeah, I think it's just that so much of writing by black authors is often necessarily kind of forced into or pigeonholed into this category of having to respond to whiteness and having to define the black experience in relation to whiteness and racism and all this negativity. And you know, that's obviously not completely the case. I think there is so much beautiful and thoughtful writing that is more about the black experience, you know, separate and irrespective to that. But I definitely realised quite early on when I was thinking about this essay that this would necessarily really place whiteness and racism at its centre. It just felt like something that I didn't want to do. I was sort of disappointed that this essay that I wanted to write about my own experiences and about blackness necessarily focused so closely on whiteness. But I also, and I talk about this in the introduction to the essay, I realised that it was just necessary, that there wasn't really any getting around it. If I wanted to have this conversation about racism and race and say, and kind of voice a lot of the discomfort I'd felt over the summer and indeed, you know, for much of my life, there was no way of writing that without talking about white people. So I just kind of had to make peace with that. And also I think it influenced the way that I positioned and wrote the essay, in that even though the title is Whites and it's about white people for the most part, it isn't necessarily for white people. So I think there are a lot of, you know, kind of anti-racist books and allyship handbooks that especially now are kind of being kind of churned out. And I very much didn't want this essay to fall into that category. I don't necessarily think just because I'm a black person writing about race that it necessarily makes it an anti-racist text or an allyship handbook. And I really wanted to make sure that there was something that in this essay, that there was a lot in this essay for black people, and that black people could read it and gain something from it. Like, I don't gain really anything from reading those sorts of, you know, allyship coach books, you know, that sort of instruct white people on how to be less racist. Of course I don't get anything out of them. And so I was just really determined that my essay would provide something, I think comfort actually, for black people, as well as I knew that white people would be reading it, so I also had to be mindful of that audience as well.
You mentioned the allyship books sort of kind of churned out, and I want to get to those in particular a little later, but it sort of hits on this phenomenon you explore of the kind of white reaction to particularly George Floyd, the kind of outpouring of surprise and indignation and shock and kind of very public and in some cases perhaps even performative kind of horror. And I found it really interesting what you say. The obvious logic, or what you describe as the obvious logic, would be that you would be gratified by this reaction, that white people are shocked by, you know, racial injustice and racially motivated killing. But in fact, it was something you found very frustrating, because you found the sort of ignorance almost willful. Can you tell me about that and sort of what your kind of process of thought with that was?
Yeah, I was just deeply frustrated by that. I just kind of thought, how can any of this come as a surprise to you? First of all, we have all seen the videos and heard the stories about police brutality, not just in the US, but also in the UK. Like, make no mistake, police brutality is also a problem in Britain. And I just kind of thought, where have you been? Like, it's no secret that racism exists. And so for me, I just didn't understand how it was that white people were surprised, you know, or sort of freshly indignant about what was happening. And I just kind of felt that that had to be a bit of a choice, like a choice to not engage with that stuff previously to this summer. And then I guess feeling like they, you know, they absolutely had to, there was no possibility, because at the end of the day, white people are the perpetrators of racism and the people who benefit from it. So how is it possible that they don't understand it? How is it possible that they're not aware of it? How is it possible that they don't fully appreciate the depth and the scope of it? It just does not tally to me. So I just found it, if not disingenuous, I just found it, as I say in the essay, just willfully ignorant.
What did you make of the sort of black square phenomenon that we saw in the aftermath, the kind of Instagram trend for posting a black square?
I didn't like it. You know, obviously that black square has kind of become symbolic of all of the kind of social media activity that, you know, happened during that period. I think it just felt so meaningless, so devoid of meaning to me. And I think a lot of people, a lot of white people, and obviously there were also black people that posted it, which is a slightly different conversation, but I think a lot of white people used it to convey meaning and solidarity and sympathy, but without actually saying anything in addition. I just kind of felt like, what does it do? How does it help me as a black person who is discriminated against to have a white person post a black square with like a black heart emoji under it? I was like, what is this doing for me versus what is it doing for you as a white person? It's making you possibly feel good, like you've done something, making you look good to certain people. It makes you look like you're engaged. It just seemed so performative to me, and it just really felt like there are better ways of trying. I mean, how is that going to dismantle racism? I don't know. I just thought it was just such a pointless throwaway action. And you know, I think the sort of originations of it certainly had meaning, but I think in general I am skeptical of some forms of social media activism. I don't think it's wholly bad by any means. Like, I think, for instance, if you look at you know, it can be a really vital way of spreading information. Social media is now a news source and a media channel, and we saw, you know, in June and beyond that it was a really effective way of, you know, sort of marshalling funds to the causes that fall under the Black Lives Matter umbrella. You know, there were bail funds, like the Minnesota Bail Fund raised like, you know, tens of millions of dollars in funding. That happened because of social media. Like, I had not heard of the Minnesota Bail Fund until I logged onto Twitter. I think where it went wrong for me is when it became performative, or that social media action of, you know, posting a black square, posting a black and white photo of Breonna Taylor, where that becomes the end goal. That for me just felt just incredibly lazy. So I wasn't a big fan of that.
A sort of kind of step on from that was the reading lists that were very popular at the time. And, you know, I think the sort of analysis of those is really interesting. The kind of, can you tell me a bit about that and sort of, I suppose, your view of them and, you know, different kinds of reading lists as well, and how you would differentiate between the kinds of books that might be included and so on?
Yeah, I mean, I don't take any, you know, umbrage with white people deciding to read books about racism or anti-racist books, if that's what we're calling them, and educating themselves further about structural racism and, you know, institutional injustice and all those sorts of things. I think that is good. But again, what I worried about is that that becomes the end goal, and that the sort of academic understanding of racism doesn't translate into really substantive action. And that almost that white people were kind of getting a false sense of achievement and thinking, okay, I don't even know if they read all the books. Certainly they bought the books. I don't know if they've been read and digested and understood and critically engaged with. But I think white people are doing these things possibly at the expense of doing things that are more difficult, that are more kind of, I guess, costly to them. It's very easy to buy a book. And also the fact that those lists really could be quite productive. You know, I mentioned the essay that my first book, Little Black Book, which is a career guide that doesn't talk about race at all, cropped up on a lot of these reading lists. I remember texting my agent actually at the time, and I was like, Little Black Book has gone up sort of Amazon charts. And I found that really deeply concerning. I was like, why are people buying this book now? Like, you know, there was just this kind of flurry of activity, and it makes every book written by a black author necessarily an anti-racist, you know, guide, which is really reductive and dehumanizing. And I felt like there was very little, you know, there are certain books that are, you know, explicitly written with the goal of educating white people about racism and allowing them to have this kind of come to Jesus moment. But there are also books that happen to be written by black people, maybe happen to be written about identity or race, that were sort of lumped in to this category, that I think really kind of denies them the luxury of being considered through any other lens aside from, oh, well, how useful is this to a white person who wants to talk about racism? Like, I don't think the writing of, you know, James Baldwin or Audre Lorde or Toni Morrison, there's a lot more to be gleaned from their writing if you think about it, let's say, in terms of like literary ability. A lot more to be gleaned from their writing than just insights on racism. And so for me, it felt really reductive.
I mean, it kind of takes away from the idea of the art. It's like, you know, it's like, isn't it just a piece of art? Why does it have to be a piece of black art?
Exactly.
You describe something which I'd not heard of before, this term weathering. Can you just explain what that is and kind of, if you're comfortable, your experience of it during that kind of traumatic summer?
Mm. So weathering is, I think it's sort of sociological / medical, kind of falls somewhere on the boundary. Certainly an academic term that is something that definitely doctors in medicine are doing more research into, but it's essentially the phenomenon that people of colour and Black people especially, as a result of kind of chronic exposure to racism and the stress of that, and, you know, the stress of seeing a video of a person who looks like you being shot to death in the news or something like that, that tends to negatively impact Black people's health, and it can lead to all sorts of like very real physical afflictions, you know, depression, anxiety, high blood pressure. And so there's currently kind of work being done into really kind of clearly understanding the link between, you know, the experience of racism and physical health outcomes. And so that kind of, I'm not a doctor, so I've probably explained that quite poorly, but that is, that phenomenon is known as weathering. That's what it's referred to. And I've long been aware of it in a kind of academic sense. I'd read about it before I understood it. But I think it was sort of maybe a week or two after George Floyd was killed, where I was just very physically and emotionally stressed and strung out as a result of having to deal with various kind of situations and conversations. And I felt physically so bad, which to me was a real revelation, because I see myself as quite a kind of feet on the ground person. Like I don't usually think that my sort of emotional state kind of really affects my physical state, even though I know that that is the case, it does. But I've always felt like quite physically resilient in that sense. But my health just really took a nosedive, and like I wasn't sleeping, wasn't really eating, felt very jittery, like my heart felt a bit funny, and thankfully that calmed down after a couple of weeks. But I suddenly thought to myself, this can't be good for my long-term health. And I suddenly sort of felt very kind of consciously aware of being weathered and of this phenomenon, you know, taking its impact on me like in the moment. And so it went from being something that I understood in a kind of rational academic sense to something that I could literally feel happening to me kind of day in, day out. And that I found just really shocking. I think it's kind of the first time that I've really felt the kind of physical stress of racism really concentrate into a specific, you know, period of time. But, you know, then I realised it's probably happening on a smaller level. More generally, it's just that this summer I felt it happen in quite an intense way.
The other thing that sounded sort of exhausting and intense was, and I thought about this a lot at the time, actually, the sort of way your reserves of energy and time were then being drawn on to assuage white people's guilt when it, you know, you say your inbox became a sort of dumping ground, and you were, well, there was also, and you know, this huge drive towards platforming Black voices and Black women at the time. And of course it's wonderful to platform Black voices and Black women, but there was also a part of me that wondered, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, if that was in some way kind of exploitative, because it's like, can you make time to do this, make time to do that, you know, can I draw on your reserves yet further to, I suppose, make me feel less guilty, and also to kind of make me, similar to the Black Square thing, make me look better. In fact, I remember thinking about that with the podcast, someone saying, are you going to get a Black author for next week now? Because, and I sort of thought, well, I don't want to just, it was a really sort of interesting and tricky kind of dilemma. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that whole phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt that there was a degree of people, of white people kind of, I guess, well-meaningly, in most cases, but sometimes I felt quite cynically kind of platforming me or spotlighting my work, especially like brands and stuff. Like I was added to so many like social media roundups by brands, just essentially kind of trying to look woke. And I actually kind of clapped back at one of them, because I was like, just take me out of this. Like, I don't like being used to make you look good, essentially. And yeah, there was a lot of that going on. And I guess what people didn't really consider is whether that attention was welcome, because I definitely didn't welcome it at the time. I, you know, gained you know, a couple of thousand followers on my Twitter and on my Instagram because of being kind of tagged in all these lists. And I didn't like it at all. Like, I nearly put both of my accounts on private just because I wanted to try and stem the flow. But then I thought, I'm then going to have to spend time kind of like going through all these requests and deciding who. And I just thought it'd be too complicated. So I just kind of left it as is. But yeah, there was definitely, and then there were kind of people asking me questions. How should I feel about this? How should I feel about that? What do you think of this? And yeah, like you say, kind of calling on my energy reserves in order to either make themselves look better or to kind of educate themselves. And I just found the whole thing very, very draining. So I think after a while, I've generally been quite good at boundaries the past few years. So I felt quite comfortable just not responding to stuff, which I think is quite lucky because I know other Black people that I know felt kind of obliged to respond to stuff. And I was just like, I don't need to respond to every or any message about this. But I think, again, there was this rush of white people kind of wanting to make themselves feel better and wanting also assurance that they were one of the good ones, I think is what it comes down to. And I wasn't willing to offer that, because that then put the discomfort back on me, and that put the sort of the mental energy of formulating these responses and these replies. It took a lot. And so after a while, I just kind of like tapped out of doing that.
Can we talk about allyship? It's something that is explored in the essay in a really interesting way. I mean, you sort of mentioned earlier the problem with the buying the books thing is that's just a nice thing to do, to go and buy some books and have them on your bookshelf. There's no inconvenience or discomfort involved at all. There's no, I suppose, self-sacrifice or going without so someone can have more. Can you kind of just, I suppose, talk me through your kind of critique of allyship and where it's useful and where it's not and how it might be bettered?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I hadn't really critically thought about the concept of allyship before the summer. I was definitely aware of it, and I actually kind of took it for granted that it was something that genuinely existed and that white people could do and aspire to and that sort of thing. But as for various reasons, you know, as the summer unfolded and I saw white people's willingness to dismantle racism and to put themselves on the line, I saw that tested. I began to doubt more and more whether allyship is something that really exists. I think it certainly exists hypothetically, but I think in reality, most white people aren't willing to do the things that would constitute true allyship, which, you know, I outline in the essay. And for me, it essentially comes down to turning down the advantages that having white skin affords you. And I'd say in the essay, it's the surrendering of racialized privileges. It's turning down the advantages that you get because you're white, and in the moment that, you know, white privilege offers itself up to you, whether it's through a job or, you know, someone making allowances for you, how are you going to respond to that? And I think also there's this tendency to think about allyship as something that white people can do for Black people and frame it as this kind of charitable act. And more and more I'm like, white people just need to focus on themselves for a bit. Like, think about how you're going to change your own life, and also think about what you're going to do that's fundamentally disruptive to the status quo and that actually redistributes power. Because as I say in the essay, you know, people have alighted on these actions like reading Black authors, amplifying Black voices, like buying from Black-owned businesses is a really popular one. But racism is so much bigger and all-encompassing and dangerous and harmful than that. It's not going to be dismantled or reversed by someone buying, you know, postcards from a Black-owned, you know, stationery brand, for instance. And you know, my mind, when it comes to this sort of thing, tends to alight on the concept of reparations, which obviously aren't happening at a structural political level. But then white people need to look at how they can do that on an individual level in their day-to-day lives. So, you know, for instance, the example I give is, you know, that as a white person, you're paid more than a Black person doing the equivalent job is likely paid. We just know that ethnicity pay gaps exist. So what are you going to do with that differential, like with that additional money that you earn solely because you are white and because somebody else is Black? What are you going to do with that? Because I think it's all very well to kind of wring, you know, your hands and say, gosh, racism is terrible and we really need to work on the pay gaps, but okay, we're here, the gaps exist. What are you going to do in the meantime?
Can I ask how comfortable you have always been, sort of what's been your journey, for want of a better word, in terms of being comfortable talking about these things? You sort of mention in the book, you know, there's this inconvenient thing, which is that some of your best friends are white. And you've often in the past found yourself, you've often found yourself talking in generality, sort of about structural racism, rather than, I suppose, more direct conversations with individuals and more targeted ones. How comfortable and uncomfortable are you, and how has that changed?
Yeah, so I think when I was a teenager and in my early 20s, I wasn't very comfortable talking about race or racism at all. And honestly, I just didn't acknowledge it and acknowledge that it was an obstacle for me, partly because I think I didn't want to accept that it was. Like, you know, I didn't want to think that my life outcomes and my opportunities might be different for me because I was black compared to my white friends. And I'd always been in kind of majority white environments. I went to a private school in London and then I went to Oxford. So these are, you know, not very racially or even socioeconomically diverse environments. So there weren't even people to have these conversations with. And again, when I went to, you know, the world of work, I worked in advertising after I left uni for 5 years. These weren't conversations that were being had. And I think, and I also hadn't, to be honest, hadn't even really grappled with the way that race affected my life or even had the language to describe why I felt uncomfortable in certain situations or why I felt certain things were racist. I think things that I now look back on and I'm like, oh, that was a racist comment, that was a racist situation. At the time, I wouldn't have used that word because it just seemed so big. And I think I've benefited a lot from the past, you know, 5 or 6 years where conversations about race and identity have become much more part of common discourse. And I now have language to describe things that I didn't have in my early 20s, or, you know, I didn't have words like microaggressions or white privilege or white fragility. I didn't even have a conceptual understanding of them. So I think I've definitely become more comfortable. And also, honestly, being self-employed and now being a writer and not feeling as beholden to anyone, and actually feeling like people expect that kind of honesty of me or appreciate that honesty from me, it's very galvanizing. You know, I don't think I could have said the things I say now when I was still working in corporate environments. And I know that I have friends and you know, let's say like social media followers who kind of message me and are like, I'm so glad you're saying this. I could never say this. I work for XY big company and, you know, I feel like you're saying the things that I'm quietly thinking. So it's definitely something I've gotten more comfortable with in the past couple of years. And I think George Floyd's death and the responses to it only like accelerated that and turbo boosted it. I mean, I think I'd say probably most people who, let's say, follow my social media accounts even before this would know that I've always been quite honest about race and racism. But I kind of felt like I owed it to myself, at least, to be as honest as I possibly could in writing this essay. So yeah, that's kind of been, I think, the evolution over the years.
Can I ask a bit of background about you? You mentioned working in advertising. Can you talk me through the decision to leave that behind and go at it alone, and also to found Women Who?
Yeah, so I got into advertising when I talk about this, actually, this whole journey, in a lot more detail in my next book, which is out next year, because that's more of a memoir. I got into advertising pretty much straight out of uni, and, you know, I thought it was a really cool, kind of fun, sexy industry. And, you know, I'd watched Mad Men, and I remember me and like one of my really close friends, he and I both thought it'd be really cool to work in advertising. We both got jobs at work in advertising, and I just didn't enjoy it for very long. I didn't really understand or appreciate office politics and didn't have a good idea of how to navigate them. I think looking back at it now, if I'd known now what I did when I started out, I'd probably have found it much easier. But I had definitely come from environments where all you had to do to succeed was kind of work hard, in the sense that, you know, if I did put in the work and the reading at university and at school, then I got the grades, and it wasn't about like making myself liked or playing the game. And working in advertising, especially in ad industries, and I think in a lot of kind of office culture, it's very much about playing the game. And I didn't understand the rules of this game. And I think also the rules of the game really benefited a certain demographic, which was white, quite posh people, and especially men. So as a kind of young, black, quite opinionated woman, I felt very kind of crushed and stifled by it. And yeah, I spent most of the time that I was working in ad agencies, which was about 5 years, kind of wanting to leave and wanting to do something new. And I think it just kind of all hit a crunch point when I turned, just after I turned 25, and I was working in a really super toxic environment, and I just couldn't hack it anymore, basically. And I also had really kind of realised, I'd always wanted to be a writer, always wanted to be a journalist, but I'd gone into advertising after uni because I felt like it was a more financially stable path. And I think, again, that crunch period in my, you know, like, I guess it's like a quarter life crisis, I really felt the burning need to at least try and pursue this career path that I kind of had always known deep down, like right from kind of childhood and teenagehood, that that was what I was interested in. So I kind of had like a big old career crisis, quit my job, moved back home with my parents. And then as part of that, I set up Women Who, which is like a platform for creative women. I'm actually wrapping up at the end of this year, but that's kind of a whole other conversation. But I set that up as a very much as a response to the last environment I worked in, which is highly misogynistic. And that really militarized me, I think, and galvanized me. And I, you know, I'd become self-employed. I was trying to kind of do more creative work. I wanted to work with other women. I'd always been really into feminism. And, you know, my career icons and idols had always been other women. And so it all just kind of merged into this platform for women and for working women, for creative women, but something that was accessible, something that I felt like you didn't need to be super senior or super cool or anything to be part of. Like, it was always supposed to be very inclusive, and I'm really proud that I think it always was, both in terms of the tone, but also in terms of the cost. Like, most of the things were either free or very cheap to access. I set that up in 2016 and then just kind of ran with that for a while.
Can you tell me the story behind The Little Black Book? Because it's a really interesting one in that you initially self-published it. And yeah. I know for any kind of aspiring writers and authors listening, it's a particularly kind of unusual and instructive story.
Yeah, it is a very unusual route to a publishing deal, actually, I think. Possibly less so now, because I have seen it happen maybe a few more times in the past couple of years. But I should say that when I self-published Little Black Book, I didn't even call it self-publishing. Like, I saw it as more a part of zine culture, like DIY zine culture, except in terms of the aesthetic and, like, you know, the kind of print quality I wanted to go for, it obviously ended up looking more like a traditional book. So I came up with the idea in order to launch Women Who. So when I was kind of working on this platform and the idea, but pre-launch, I just felt like I didn't know how I was going to make it stand out and really kind of grab people's attention and get people involved and engaged with it. But also, I kind of wanted to set out my story as to what Women Who was about, because there were and remain like quite a lot of like women's platforms that were sort of very like fluffy and like paid lip service to women's empowerment, but they didn't actually do very much. And I wanted to set out my stall as being quite like a practical, if even slightly boring, like platform, but like something that was actually really useful that you would go to and find tangible resources that you could apply to your own career and your own life and get results. Like, even though that isn't necessarily particularly sexy, I just kind of thought that that's what I wanted and that's what I felt was missing. So it was quite a last minute decision. I think I wrote the whole thing and like around, I was at the time freelancing, just doing like a full-time job, working like 9 to 5 or 7 or whatever, at an ad agency I was freelancing at in order to pay for it all. And then like in the mornings and in the evenings, at the weekends, and I'm going to be honest, a little bit during the day, I would put together this book. And I remember just sending the idea to a few of my friends, being like, oh, if I wrote like a little mini kind of handbook, would you buy it, would you read it, would you be interested? And one of my friends was like, yeah, it would be just like, you know, that little mini pocketbook that Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie put out, We Should All Be Feminists. So that then became my reference. I was, oh yeah, these work quite well, like these kind of gifty books. You know, I had a copy of that book and really loved it. And like when I was like going into like printer's office, like I literally managed the print production process myself, I would take that in as a little example. I was, oh, this is what I'm trying to do, but like in this color and whatever. So I kind of banged out these like 10 very short chapters, like it's a short book. And then when I launched Women Who, and when I put, you know, I did a print run of 250 copies, to my total surprise, because I did not have a social media following at all at this stage, I, you know, like had like a few hundred followers on Instagram. Like, it was very much not like a public figure kind of vibe. The book sold out in 2 days. And I'd been savvy enough to pitch it to journalists at like creative companies. So it had been picked up by It's Nice That. And then somehow it got picked up by Fast Company, which was like amazing, because then that went live in the US and I got loads of US orders. And it sold out really quickly. And I was like, oh, this is weird. This is cool. I was planning another print run. And then somebody who bought a copy gave it to my now editor at Fourth Estate, Michelle. And I guess told her, like, oh, would you be interested in this? And so I get, you know, a message from Michelle, do you want to go for a meeting? And the way it was framed is that she was going to give me advice on how to market the second print run that I just ordered, so like 500 copies this time. And then actually I went to this meeting and she was like, oh no, I'd like to offer you a book deal, which was just incredible. And then really kind of weirdly and spookily at this coffee meeting, she brought out a book from her bag and she was like, oh, I was thinking it could be something like this. And she brought out Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's book, and that, you know, Chimamanda is published by Fourth Estate. So my editor had worked on that book, and it was just like this weird serendipitous thing. And that's how I ended up getting my first book deal and I guess getting into being a published author. Sorry, that's quite a long story.
No, it was a really interesting story. I'm going to wrap it up soon because I don't want to take up too much of your time. But before I do, I mean, I was going to ask what's next for you, but I sort of know what's next, which is money. We need to talk about money. And I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit about that and what people can expect.
Yeah, so that We Need to Talk About Money is coming out in May 2021, published by Fourth Estate. And it is a part memoir, part cultural commentary about my relationship with money and my experiences over the years, and particularly throughout my 20s, and what those experiences say about the world around us, and particularly about women's kind of broader relationships with money. So it's, you know, it touches on lots of different subjects. It's like race and gender, obviously, but also like class and privilege and beauty standards and invisible labour and, you know, home owning and renting and generation rent and all these things. And it's like a very personal book. And I essentially came up with the idea, funny enough, just before Little Black Book was properly published by Fourth Estate. So this was the spring of 2017, because I was kind of getting like doing the press run, and like people were so excited, this book is coming out. And I was just like not making that much money. And I really felt the disconnect between feeling quite anxious about money and then the kind of external persona that I had and felt pressured to maintain of this kind of like, you know, debut author, like it's all very glamorous and launch parties and events and that sort of thing. And I remember walking home one night just feeling really quite anxious about it. And at that moment, I just thought, there is a story in this. There is a book in this. And again, kind of just sat on the idea for like a good year, just started making notes. I think the kind of original pitch was sort of like a book about women's emotional relationships with money. And then it's just kind of grown and grown and grown. I sent a draft to a friend the other month who's designing the book cover. And she was like, it's about so much more than money. She was like, it's really not what I expected. I think a lot of people are expecting it to be a kind of like guidebook or like a how-to guide or like an economics book. But it's essentially like a memoir, but kind of told through the kind of the connecting thread is my thoughts on money and my relationship with money throughout the years. So yeah, that's what's next. I'm finishing that up at the moment, and that'll be out in next year.
And will you come back on to talk about it?
Absolutely.
I'm going to hold you to that now. Okay, my final question, which is a question I ask everyone who comes on, is if you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I wish that I had trusted my instinct a little bit more. So again, that first 5 years of my career when I was working in advertising, I definitely had a lot of people, a lot of colleagues, a lot of managers who doubted me and put me down. And I remember in one performance review, my boss was like, you're too ambitious. And I really internalized that. I just wish that, yeah, I'd backed myself a bit more and realized that they were the problem, not me. Which I think is, you know, possibly quite hard to have that realization when you're like a 22-year-old and you're just starting out and, you know, like you're a real overachiever and you want to kind of crack this corporate nut. But I can see now that it took such a toll on my self-esteem and my confidence in a way that really wasn't necessary. So I wish I had just had a bit more faith in my ideas and ability during that period of time.
That is good advice and a great note to end on. Natega, thank you so much for your time. It was absolutely fascinating talking to you. I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. This was a really fun interview.
And to everyone listening, Whites on Race and Other Falsehoods is out now. So that's it from us. Thank you very much for listening to the Sunday Salon. Please do share your thoughts about the episode with me. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Alice Azania. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please do think about leaving a rating or review, because it really helps other people find it. And I love to read them. So until next week, thank you very much and goodbye.